look at it, it's responding to our voice. This is.
So that's good.
Okay, good. So we don't have to enunciate.
No, and I think.
Me.
And I think what I will do is I will. So 00097.
Where do you see that?
7? Right there. That's the.
Oh, I see. Oh.
That's the code for this particular interview.
Isn't that good?
But, so I'll insert like a little bio thingy at the beginning.
That one that's on the program is fairly up to date.
Yeah.
And there's more on my website.
Yeah, I'll go to your website.
There's tons of stuff on the website.
Look, you can download. You know you can download the Mormon in China for free?
Yeah. No, but look at my skin. It's good.
I know, old man skin. I know.
It's a just horrible old man skin. Look at it. I look like my grandfather.
No, you don't have old man skin. You just look like sun.
I do. But no, it looks all white and lumpy. And never mind. Death. Let's talk about death. The interview is about death. And there goes the ambulance. The ambulance coming to pick us up.
That's right. Well,
you first. You know, my brother, we took his dog into the Daisy to be euthanized last summer. And she was a beautiful golden lab, and she was 15. They just adored her. And there's great weeping by his wife, Sharon, when, you know, while we were waiting for Paul, because she couldn't get up finally in the summer. Like, she could. He went outside, and she just couldn't get her mind up. That was time. She was old and riddled with illnesses. But we took her to the vet, and Paul was, you know, big strapping brother, RCMP, former RCMP, tough as nails, you'd think. But he was just ruined by it.
Yeah.
And but he Daisy was in the back seat of the car, and Paul went in to get the vet. And the vet came out. The vet came out, stuck his head in the door, and said, "Okay, which one is first?" And Paul, of course, put him up to it.
No.
And I said, "Try it out on Paul. If it works on Paul, we'll do the dog." Okay, which one's first? Death, what are you going to do with?
How many plays have you written?
12.
12 plays and a novel?
Two novels.
Two novels, including the crime story?
The crime novel, yeah.
Yeah. Anything else?
Essays. I have a ton of essays.
Yeah. Are those available on your website?
No. I think the most...
I'd love to read them.
The one that's of real interest, again, going back to that Aboriginal early settler question, too, is there was a book published by McClellan and Stewart, called What is a Canadian?
Yeah.
And 30 Canadian writers were asked to write. I think it was a 2,500 word essay.
General's Award.
Or writers who, you know, Canadian writers.
Yeah.
And that was published, I think, in 2004 or 5. But that's a really interesting essay. That was quoted by. The name, which I can't think of now, major Canadian editor, edited all the greats with McClellan and Stewart. It'll come to me. Scottish. Great man.
Yeah, he died, but there was a book that came out about him when I was in Toronto.
No, he's still living.
Then it's not the guy I'm thinking
of. Oh dear.
I mean, I probably would know if you could remember. But
yeah.
It'll come to
you. Anyway, there's a quote in that essay, which he used and still uses. He has a wonderful book out about writing about Canada. You know, about editing Canada's great writers, like he did Alice Munro and et cetera.
Alistair MacLeod, is he the guy
he got the
manuscript. I know he is. Arriving with a bottle of scotch.
Getting him drunk and snatching when he wasn't looking
no
and running.
Skip. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Jack
MacLeod.
No, that's the company. Anyway, but he quoted that, and there's a quote in that essay that I was really happy with, talking about the... in Europe, the Enlightenment resulted in the revolution and the horror in Scotland. The Enlightenment resulted in Canada.
And oh, that, you Scots!
I know, we're just relentless with our, you know, our
self-aggrandizement.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and we just like to get the facts straight. People, let's get quite clear as to who organized the country.
Yeah.
Now, the British may have dominated and behaved badly, but the Scots got it right. So it's awful, isn't it? It's so tiresome.
Yeah, but it's good. It's a great quote.
Yeah.
It's a very great quote.
Yeah. And that also appears in this. There's a thing in the Canadian Theatre Review after Warm Wind in China was premiered by Don Ray Downton, an essay plus the text of Warm Wind in China.
Yeah.
And she talks about, she did an interview when I lived in Southwood Drive, and she very, very sort of graciously, but not, you know, not, wasn't deeply hidden, talked about the writer's sense of how, you know, he knows, he and he alone knows how the world should run, and that he's always right. And I thought,
do you think that's a bad thing?
I don't know. Well, that's what I have to.
I think it's pretty good.
It's been haunting me for like 25 years.
There's a whole lot of writers who I would let run the universe before most people who run for public office.
Oh, I wouldn't. Oh, God, writers should be kept home where they belong. Oh, dear.
I'd let you run the universe. Run it for sure.
Oh, my Lord.
But anyway, you'll discover. I want to come back to that quote later, but I want to hear. I want to hear about your childhood a little bit. I want to hear you talk about PEI.
Mm-hmm.
So go.
Well, like I said, I was born on the wagon of a traveling show.
Yeah.
Mom used to dance for me. Well, rural PEI in the 50s, it was still connected to, you know, the Victorian era, really. Dad had just, I was born in a house without lights, with no phone. I was with, you know, lanterns. I got electricity the year I was born. Dad started farming with a horse and plow. But the tractor had come onto the farm. At one point, there was three generations living in this big old farmhouse. My crazy old, desperately ill great-grandfather, Tom Stetson, he'd been living there by himself, and when Mom and Dad moved in, he was in an upstairs bed, insane, loused, and, you know. So it was, the PI was very rough then, Hugo. I mean, there was no...
There was no tourist industry.
There was no, and it was, PEI's become romanticized with Anne of Green Gables, and it was a fabulously wealthy society, but it was rough.
Yeah.
It was really rough, and if you didn't have, you know, family to support you in that wonderful combination of slavery in a way, and working on a farm is slavery because you're just a slave, essentially, you know, from the time you can start to hew wood and draw water.
Yeah.
But it's also glorious too, because it's it's healthy. And the family was a family of Highland Scots. That's who we are. And generations of storytellers and singers, and
Catholic,
Protestant, Presbyterian, but not the Dour Presbyterian. It was kind of an enlightened Presbyterian from the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
The thing about PEI that was fascinating is that, much of the Scottish immigration to Nova Scotia, PEI, Cape Breton, and then, you know, out west later with the Selkirk settlers, was that these people came with books,
yeah,
and perhaps a Bible, but certainly they came with literature, and they were farmers, and the first thing they built in PEI, in the Presbyterian, in the Scottish Presbyterian and Protestant communities, wasn't a church, it was a school. And the whole community revolved around the school, and the church was secondary.
Yeah.
And that was still if I leap forward to I was 9 or 10 years old, that's where I started, you know, performing.
Mm-hmm.
Was in the Marshfield Community Hall, which was on our property, would hold 150 people.
Wow.
And every community had a community hall, and there was, it was for, you know, meetings and performances and concerts, and so it was integral. It was just natural to our life.
Yeah.
You know, you work your ass off in the barn, then you go to a concert at night with your mother and father in it.
When did the family arrive?
Mom's family was first from Scotland.
Do you know from where it's called?
Yes, it's all Highlands. McPherson's. It's inland Highland. It's not. It's not the Hebrides. McPherson is the family name. And there were also McPhees, and that's in 1820, something around there. Dad's family was a little bit later. They come on the Hector, that's the same population.
Right,
Antigonation Picto, which is, what, is that the 1850s, maybe?
Yes.
Somewhere in there.
So.
Yeah. So his family arrived a bit later. So, and my grandfather, who I wrote, Queen of the Cadillac. Have you read that play? It did extremely well.
Mm.
It did very well. It's a and he is the central figure in that play. And based on his life, he didn't speak English till he was 14. And spoke Highland Scots, Gaelic, as they call it. They call it the Gaelic. And he was a great storytelling singer.
You pronounce it.
Well, we learned everything we know about the Gaelic from you.
Exactly.
It was yours first. We took it across the water,
St.
Columba.
Oh, goodness.
Who our church was named after.
Same civilization again and again and again.
The
Irish. You can have the founding of Canada, but my God, we saved Europe.
You saved. The Irish saved Europe. And not a minute too soon. So all that stuff was going on then, and Granddad was a remarkable man, because he was selected by the village elder, a woman named Shauna Navour, when she was getting old and she had no children. But she was the really the repository of the culture, medicine, veterinary practice. She was the village elder. She knew what needed to be. She knew everything about the history and everything to do with agriculture, with physical health for humans and for animals.
And I'm sorry, I'm spending so much time on this, I really do want to get to you, but this is fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any connection between Cape Breton and PEI?
Fishing.
Was there back and forth?
A lot of intermarriage.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
Yeah.
And all Scottish Presbyterians. There's a lot of Catholic, but primarily, Nova Scotia, Cape Breton is primarily Scottish Catholic.
Yeah.
Made a difference, but there were small pockets of fishing back and forth. And it all, every now and then, to be a Catholic girl run away from home and marry a Presbyterian, and the opposite, which caused great shame and consternation to everybody. Shauna Navour was really interesting, a really interesting character too, because she took my grandfather, she selected him, and took him to her house for 2 years, between the ages of 14 and 16. And poured it into him, and that's what Caledonia the musical is about, in Charlottetown as well, and Queen of the Cadillac, the play. Musical's an outgrowth of the play.
I need to read this.
I'll send them to you.
Absolutely, yeah. I would love it.
Yeah.
I want anything you like. I want to read. But
yeah. It's all on PDF. I can just send it to you. Print it up if you like.
So this is that's the background, and that's where you were born.
Yeah. 1948. 1940.
That's actually the year my sister was born.
Oh, was she?
Yeah,
what month?
Age as my sister. She was. I think she's an Aries.
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure exactly when. But
yeah.
I think she's an Aries. She certainly is very, very, very goat-headed.
Goat-headed. And Wanda and I are Cancers, which is why we get along together. She was born the 4th. I was the 5th of July. And something about us that just ripples back and forth.
Nice.
It's like liquidy Cancer stuff.
Nice. So you start your performance. I mean, I'd love to hear about your debut, but when did the writing start?
My grandfather was a great storyteller, and my mother was a writer, and my father was a great storyteller and cartoonist. On the farm, just privately in the house,
yeah.
And he used to do cartoons of us with little dialogue and stuff.
Lovely.
Yeah, my mother, we published three books of her poetry. You know, Vanity Press. She had grade eight education, so. But the poetry was all domestic, but every now and again she'd hit something.
Yeah.
That was just remarkable.
Yeah.
And of course with my grandfather, Danny Lockie McPherson, who was injured in the war, post-traumatic stress disorder, which was then called shell shock, and he was a raging alcoholic. He was prone to deep depressions. His wife died. Mom was like, there are five kids in mom's family. One of them, the mother died when mom was 10. One of the children died soon after the house burned down. My grandfather just went to pieces, but he always came back to storytelling. And was studied to death by the University of Edinburgh as the last Gaelic speaker native-born Gaelic speaker in PEI, and one of two, the other was in Cape Breton.
Right.
And so it was like that tendril of, had, you know, crossed the Atlantic in the mid-1800s, or the early, late 1700s, and planted itself, and then the vine was snipped. And the Gaelic community that grew there was absolutely distinct.
Mm-hmm.
It's a language ancient. It didn't exist anymore in Scotland. So it became like a repository.
It's tragic that how successful the English were at eliminating Irish.
Mom went to school at a certain point. She remembers having to wear a shingle if she spoke Gaelic.
Yeah.
And punished for it. So.
Yeah. Really? I think it's one of the reasons why I identify with the Aboriginal struggle.
Yeah.
It's because of the destruction of Gaelic culture in Ireland, obviously, but the fact that I have no knowledge of my language.
Yeah. But blame can only go so far, because you can always learn it. and society.
Don't be difficult.
And societies can always reconstruct.
I am wounded.
Yeah. Oh, get over it.
I am wounded.
Oh.
Well, I just mean everything the English learned, right? They tried it out on the Irish.
And also, you know, in terms, right?
They took everything they learned in Ireland and they
applied it everywhere else.
The islands.
But it's, you know, and I have great grievances against the British, but they also did brilliant things.
Yes.
You know, and I just can't live an unbalanced life; otherwise, I become cranky and I go nuts.
Yeah.
So
we have the writing, the writing tradition. But when did you start to write?
The first thing I remember writing was two things. We're going to Caledonia to see my grandfather in the fall, and writing about the landscape. And I was, about color.
Yeah.
So we're just writing about color and image, and the Caledonia hills and PEI. It's all hardwood, stunning. So I remember being like 8 or 9 or something, coming home writing something about that trip. And I also then remember being 16. And I was flown out to Regina for Paul's graduation from the RCMP. For some reason or other, my parents didn't go, they couldn't go, it was too expensive, but they sent me. It was the first time in an airplane, first time off PEI, second, well. And I remember writing about that, writing an essay. I was in grade 10, so I was 16.
Yeah.
And the sensation of the seat pressing against my back and moving without control up and away.
Yeah.
Was the image that still sits, that still sticks.
Nice.
Yeah. That, those are very. And I was a singer as a child. I was 5 years old. I was trotting around. My voice changed on stage as a singer. Singing.
That must have been. It's terrifying.
It was. It was very terrifying. It was in front of Lester Pearson, who was the Prime Minister then, at a Liberal rally in Charlottetown for 1,500 Liberals at Queen Charlotte High School.
God, and your voice.
Valdery, Valdera, Valdery, Valdera, Valdery, Valdera.
Oh, okay.
It was really horrible. But
I
went through it.
Yeah.
And I was okay, except for about 4 notes in the chorus.
Yeah.
You know how it goes, la, 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 la. Come off stage and Pearson put his arm around my shoulder and said, "Don't worry, son, you're becoming a man."
Oh, I loved Lester.
Oh, what a sweet man.
Yeah, my mom met him.
Did she?
Yeah, she actually had they went back to his house in Ottawa. I think it was in Stornoway.
He was in the opposition at that time.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
It was probably in the Diefenbaker years.
Yeah, your mother was an interesting woman, wasn't she?
She was. She was a very, very... She lived in an upper middle class family. Her father was a banker.
Yeah.
In Regina, so they lived better than most people through the Depression. But he sounds like an absolute nightmare because I never met anybody.
He was Irish?
He was Scottish.
He was Scottish, yeah.
Catholics.
Yeah.
Catholic Scots.
Oh, they can be terrifying.
And she was educated by the nuns. The Ku Klux Klan came to Regina, burned a cross and, outside the school, outside the convent. Just.
I have to get out of the sun. I have to get out of the sun. I'm getting burned.
Yeah. It's.
I love it, but. Should we just go from the. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Sorry, I just feel
it. No,
just,
it's me too.
My 20 minutes.
I knew it would happen. In their white sheets.
And what did your grandfather do?
He was banker. He was the Bank of Montreal.
Yeah.
And he was an alcoholic, and horrible to the point that my grandmother left him with she didn't take the kids. She left the kids with him.
Oh my!
She just escaped.
She
back to Ontario, which is where she was from.
Oh Lord! She just ran.
Yeah, yeah.
Monster.
And then he got MS, and my mother ended up having to be a caregiver after she'd gone off to war and come back. And
right.
Anyway. That's not my interview. It's your interview, Donnie.
It's all the same stuff.
It is all. It's all the same story. The whole unfolding story of our lives and our country.
Absolutely.
The you went on this trip and you wrote about it. When did the theater start to enter into the picture?
Next door in the community hall from childhood.
Yeah. From childhood.
Oh, absolutely.
What, nativity plays? Like what did,
absolutely,
what did
and skits, and in skits and sketches.
Yeah.
And my mother and Marguerite Godfrey next door, and Doris Macbeth, her best pals, Athol, Doris Macbeth's husband, Cedric Ballum, they all love theater.
Wow.
And these are all farmers, and they, finish at work, and you get these little sketches from, I don't know where they came from, the Women's Institute, which was huge on Prince Edward Island, and... So it was a Women's Institute hall, and these community halls were established all across the country, or all across PEI, and it was a massive organization. And the men did...
Just for the betterment of society, right?
For the betterment, and women run, controlled, absolutely huge. And oftentimes in the PEI and the farms, the women controlled the finances.
Yeah.
And the men would handle all the banking and stuff, but a lot of the books would be kept by the wives, and they'd so there was great division of power naturally on PEI, and the women were very powerful provincially, and had a provincial voice.
Is that why you're all gay?
There's only three gay people on PEI. Two now that I've left. I wonder, are strong-minded mommies? No, it's why PEI has a feminine persona.
Yeah,
it does. Just the land is always springing forth. It's in that kind of traditional phrase. What's his name? Fraser, the great mythologist. Robert Fraser, not Robert Fraser.
Golden Bough.
Golden Bough. Yeah. That sense of the feminine reproduction. The earth being fertile, and
cycles of
the moon, and all that stuff, and PI is very much in that kind of psychological terror.
It feels like that. I mean, from my own tiny little experience of PI, 24 hours there, it's all lush and verdant and little rolling hills.
And so fecund,
unctuous
and fecund. Stuff coming in, like stuff coming out of the water. The land producing extraordinarily great dairy, great what's more feminine than milk, and tons of it, high quality cheese and all that stuff. And the other thing, for Confederation Center, it's interesting, the summer festival, without anybody thinking of it or considering it, always does musicals about women,
Anarion Gables, Mary Queen of Scots, Evangeline.
Right.
You look at the whole, and occasionally like someone like Walter Learning came in who did some pretty horrible things like the all this stuff that just lost.
Yeah.
Like it's horrible. It was just lost in the council funding.
When did this festival start?
67. Yeah. With Anna Green Gables, which is a brilliant show. Have you ever seen it?
No.
It's a great piece of, it's a big old, 1950s Broadway style book musical.
It was Maver Moore, wasn't it?
Maver Moore, Don Herron, and Elaine Campbell, Norman Campbell, who was the composer. The music is glorious.
Yeah.
The lyrics are brilliant. I mean, they're really sharp and smart, and the book is Don Herron, it's terrific. So there's this last couple of generations and a lot of people of our generation are pretty sniffy about Anne of Green Gables and all silly stuff, but it's brilliant.
No, I finally read it actually, and I read it as an adult. I didn't read it as a kid, and it's a terrific book.
It's a great novel.
It's a really really good book.
Yeah. It really is. And they got that on stage, like Matthew's death in the end of Act Two, toward the climax of Act Two. 1,200 people just weeping.
Yeah.
You know, the theater goes dead silent, and you hear 1,200 people, and how many, that's happened thousands of times in hundreds of languages.
Yeah.
Well, not hundreds, but dozens of languages, literally. And that's success, no matter how you,
Yeah, it's true.
And it's very funny, and people just love that character, so anyway, that's the P.I.'s anima.
When did you're doing sketches, you're singing, you're performing for the Prime Minister, Lester Pearson. Certainly not the last of the great intellectuals, but the last of the sort of the international.
Yeah, the great thinkers.
And of that, born out of that tradition of duty that was that informed our public service.
Yeah. The betterment of all,
by
hard work.
Yeah, and saying, no, I owe it to my country to earn less by working in the public service. I'm resigning my chairmanship of the BMO, and I'm going to go and be in the Department of Foreign Affairs.
Well,
the ethos.
That was the ethos.
Yeah.
And that combination of him, of Lester Pearson and Tommy Douglas at the same time, Tommy Douglas coming after, because Tommy Douglas is just a remarkable, from the same Scottish Enlightenment tradition, both of them, back to that.
Yeah.
Because that's where Pearson comes from,
too. I didn't know that. I always assumed Pearson was much more
England. And the French, and the Scottish and French Enlightenments that built this country, essentially. Forget the British. Put the British aside.
Yeah.
They sort of organized the muscle. But what was going on underneath, and banking, the Scottish Parliament, a combination of French and Scottish. It's all from the Enlightenment, which never really took in Britain.
No.
It never really did.
No, except in Scotland.
That's right.
Huge.
And it was separate from Britain because of the connection between France and Scotland.
Yeah.
Both of them hated England, you see. In combination, like the three great forces that built Canada.
It did take root in Ireland, but it was crushed.
It was crushed by the British.
They
couldn't do it in Scotland because they couldn't find
them.
O'Connor
was certainly the liberator. He was certainly getting the penal laws.
Right.
So
my thesis and much of my work from the very beginning is that the founding of Canada from a not a nationalistic point of view, more a theoretical point of view, is that Canada was founded by the French, the Scottish, and the First Nations people, in combination, working together extraordinarily well. The brutality comes from the English, and the ugliness becomes. But those connections are still like. I can't recommend enough this Frank McGugan's Fatal Passage.
I will read it
about anything that brings you the Courrier du Bois. From the French era of running the fur trade with the primarily the Cree.
I've always had ever since I was a kid. I've always had a fascination with Champlain.
And that's what my thing
is. To me, he's a great he is a great hero, and it's really the true founder of the country.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, and that's what the next novel is about. Because The World Above the Sky is a trilogy. The World Above the Sky, the Earth World is the second, and these are all from Mi'kmaq. The Mi'kmaq live in six worlds. The World Below the World Above the Sky, the Sky World, the Earth World, the World beneath the Earth, and the World Beneath the Sea. And these all, that's where Mi'kmaq mythology, cosmology, sits.
Wow.
So the first book, The Earth, the World Above the Sky, researched extensively at the Nova Scotia Museum with the wonderful Ruth Whitehead. Do you know Ruth?
I certainly know her name, and I've heard her.
Extraordinary. Yeah. And we spent, she read the proof, she proofed the books. It came from a play first. It was a commission from Michael at Parsboro.
Oh yeah.
Fuller.
Yeah.
Michael Fuller. Yeah. He commissioned this play because I had this notion of Henry Sinclair and the Mi'kmaq at Pictou. And Pictou is a Mi'kmaq word meaning fart. Because of the sulfur, the coal that was there would often catch fire and burn.
Wow.
So Pictouk is the Mi'kmaq name of Pictou. Pictouk,
so,
means fart.
Because
the sulfur. So I love that whole notion. And the hero of the piece is look at that beautiful crow.
I love the crows in
Halifax. Yeah. The hero of the novel and the play as well. The play was called, what was the play called? It'll come back to me. Is the young chief god,
mm-hmm.
or chief in waiting, young god, mm-hmm. Clearly manifested as a god,
mm-hmm.
Being trained and raised by a woman called Walkwa.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Mintwokusk. And so it's Mintwokusk and Eugenia St. Clair de la Croix, who was the virgin who was taken pregnant from Britain for the Knights Templar.
Right.
It's all that stuff,
right.
Which is fascinating. So she's the embodiment of the blood of Christ. And her child dies as soon as they arrive here. She's 19, she's exquisite. No, she's 18, exquisite. He's 19 and beautiful.
Yeah.
And of course they run off together. Of the Mi'kmaq,
wow.
the old Scottish Enlightenment.
I'm dying to read this.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely dying to read this.
So that's where that came from. Is Michael Fuller commissioned this play called what did I call the play?
It'll come to you.
But it was never done because Scott Burke took over and Scott went, "Man, it's time to know what you want to mean." And I said,
"I won't put that."
No, and I said, "Fuck off, Scott." I did. I really said, "You know, you don't get this play, and I'm not going to rewrite it because it was through six drafts by then."
Mm.
And he thought it was that I had no right to write about Mi'kmaq.
Cultural appropriation.
I was voice appropriation, culturation. I said, "No. This is so far beyond that."
Yeah.
You know, this is designed to reinvent both of us and to speculate on what might happen had things gone the way they had gone initially, and let's take the premise.
Well, that's what all great art is always about. What if?
Yeah.
What if, you know?
Yeah. So Michael Fuller, bless his heart, is still plugging away, trying to find a way to produce this.
Is he really?
Yeah. He loves this piece, and he had some great ideas.
I like Fuller.
Yeah, I like Michael. Always did.
He and Greg are very good friends. Greg's him.
Yeah.
Very. Very
that speaks well of both of them.
Friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
And I was glad to hear he's a good friend of Tom's, because Tom is difficult.
Yeah. Greg's a remarkable person.
Yeah.
Really remarkable person.
I
was so happy to have that time with him last night.
Yeah. On your birthday especially.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so back to you. And we've gotten you now to we've gotten you engaged in the theater. Doing skits.
Tom Gallant again. Was the real first, was the where it became serious. Tom was in PEI at St. Dunstan's University, the Catholic University.
Mm-hmm.
I was Prince Wales College, the Protestant University, where Lucy Maud Montgomery studied. We had a long and lovely tradition. including a link to McGill, so it was a junior college.
Mm-hmm.
So after you finished your, you did grade 11 and 12 and first and second years of university at Prince of Wales. Then if you were a good student, you went to McGill.
Right.
So, and that was in place for a long time. Or Dalhousie, you had a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a formal link, so that was a very, and it comes
has
back.
Has that become UPI? Has that,
yeah.
Is that there?
Yeah. And it goes back to that, those people coming in ships with a bookload, a bagload of
yeah.
books and no Bible.
Yeah.
That's where that comes from.
Yeah.
It's really that education was so, it's a remarkable thing.
Yeah. So how did you meet Tom?
We were at college. His the woman who became his wife, Kathy Miller, she was then, and I, we met when we were 17 years old on the way to theater class. Brand new thing, theater, what the hell, you know, a formal study of theater in the Prince of Wales College went through a renaissance, which the government killed. It was a remarkable, it was liberal arts college. It blossomed into this wonderful liberal arts college for 4 years and then was killed and amalgamated with the Catholic University, which had very dubious standards. If you know, it wasn't even Jesuit based. It was,
right.
And it was the curriculum was limited, and you know, science was a joke, and the humanities were not bad as they'd done, because they had benefit of Thomas Aquinas and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But politics and history was all very warped. And Prince Wales, we had a lot of American draft dodgers teaching us at the time, and they were fantastic. These brilliant Americans,
yeah.
You know, liberal-minded, leftist American. That's who was teaching. It's one of the reasons why it got squished by the Alec Campbell government.
Yeah.
And wonderful principal Frank McKinnon, brilliant man.
Yeah.
And I have another. I did the inaugural Frank McKinnon lecture for the Confederation Center. UPEI is a Frank McKinnon lecture series. I saw
nice.
I could send that too. That's a good. That's
yeah.
an interesting piece.
The so you did you start thinking of it as a career at that point?
I was taking an English degree with a minor in sociology.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that's where I belonged, but I didn't know how it would unfold.
Yeah.
Tom had written a play called The Caretaker, and I was in the lead, had the lead in the piece,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing a lot of back. My voice had come back, and I was singing in the
yeah.
choir, and I had played Tommy Albright in Brigadoon,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing, you know, like, and I was out there again.
Yeah.
Tom, we were just for a theater, like, we just knew nothing, we're all babies.
Yeah.
And we're in, I remember distinctly
making
Tom,
it up. You were
Tom,
inventing
Tom,
the theater.
And Tom was a very good instinctual playwright.
Yeah.
He was like 20, you know. I remember knowing that I was in trouble in one of the rehearsals when they all smoked all the time, you know,
mm-hmm.
and like in the classrooms and everywhere, rehearsing in the classroom. I had a cigarette for a long time and a match lit for a long time, and I finally brought. I was watching the Tom direct, or what he thought was directing at the time, and I was lighting, and the cigarette was left halfway up, you know, because it was so intense, and suddenly it went boom, and I thought, I'm hooked.
Yeah,
I was
yeah,
so
yeah.
far gone, and the whole cigarette
set yourself
boom.
On fire. That's
set
brilliant.
Myself on fire.
That's because you know you're an actor or a theater artist when.
Yeah, but I think it really kicked in. After I left university, I did the Young Canadian Hippie Trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I was rehearsing, I was actually rehearsing a piece, a comedy, and missed all my final exams,
mm-hmm.
And got my Christmas mark, my graduating year, which was really lucky because they were really good, but I had done nothing from Christmas to the spring because I was rehearsing this play. I can't remember what it was called, comedy, you know. And I got appendicitis before the show went up, and I was rushed into emergency like 2 weeks before exams. And I got all my Christmas marks, so that was good. So my degree is a bit of a fraud.
Yeah.
It should have been like a B+ instead of an A-. It was a bit fraudulent there. Because
Yeah.
And I took literature, studied a lot of literature, Shakespeare, theater. I still have nightmares, you know, those university nightmares. But they're not that I haven't studied the course, it's that I'm in university forever. The nightmares that, you know, those lack of completion nightmares? something.
Where you're taking an exam and you haven't read the book.
No, it's different than that. I've been in this course forever.
Oh, wow.
And they're going to find out that I'm like 65 years old and I'm still taking these courses.
Yeah.
And you have to, and I never finish them. And I just like, and I go back every year in the nightmare and register again and say, I'll start again. And then by the end of it, it's blah, blah, blah.
That's a very weird dream. I've never in my life had a dream like
it's
that.
It's just ridiculous. It all goes back to that.
It sounds like a metaphor for life.
It does,
really.
Doesn't it? Oh, dear. Then out of that came the Charlottetown Lunchtime Theatre. I was traveling in Scotland doing the Young Canadian Hippie Trip, went to Edinburgh, saw the saw a Lunchtime Theatre there. That was 1970.
Yeah.
And came back to PEI and assembled all my buddies, and we rented a church hall, and I got a grant for $12,500. From the Opportunities for Youth program, and I grew 5 acres of potatoes that same year. And so it's either going to be farming or theater, and both came through. It was a great crop, and I made a few $1,000s from the potatoes.
Yeah, yeah.
Got the grant and opened a theater.
Yeah.
And we did. Then I started commissioning work, new work. So that was the 70s when Canadian theatre was just popping.
Really, really popping.
When the repertoire, the Canadian repertoire commenced, really.
Yeah.
It was going on in Tarragon, it was going on in Newfoundland, it was going on in BC, and it was going on in Charlottetown in the 70s. We didn't know. It just kind of, and it was Pierre Trudeau, it was, and Lester Pearson, and the Scottish Enlightenment, and the books coming across on the boats ties it all together. Make your own culture.
So how long did that last?
About 9 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, but I left it after about the second or third year. We did a show called Kid Humbley's First Game.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one with Peter Kratz.
Right.
Eventually, when we took, but we started off in Charlottetown with writer Kent Thompson from New Brunswick. He was really interested in our little theater. He wrote a 45-minute play about this down and out hockey team in New Brunswick with a thug of a manager, car salesman, who put his team together by coercing guys who couldn't make their car payments.
Right.
It was a great play, a little comedy, and it was set up in three acts: before the game, first intermission, second intermission, or whatever, not intermission,
yeah.
You know,
and
they
after
call
the
them.
Game?
Then after the game.
Yeah.
And each of them around 15 minutes each. People
yeah.
brought their lunch, and we had people that was, cooking turkeys and hams and making sandwiches and all that stuff. And this John Hirsch saw it and invited me to be one of 9 directors from across Canada to be trained in television direction by the BBC. And that I was
holy
about,
shit.
Yeah, so I was around 24 at that time. 25. And went to London and then Toronto and then direct television for years.
What?
So I went away from Lunchtime Theatre, but it kept going.
And did you, so when you were directing television, did you move to Toronto?
Halifax, that's how I ended up in Halifax.
Right.
So I was 23 or something, and that's when, and I had a long answer to your question, that's when I became a writer in Halifax.
But it's nice to know the backstory to the backstory, really.
Yeah.
Because you're always so, as a writer, you're so conscious of where people come from.
And
absolutely. And what's made them, what are the forces that have molded your characters, and that's something that always strikes me.
Again, it's that Scottish clannishness.
Yeah.
It's that clan. That's my mother says. She always said, you're just clannish like you're supposed to be. Whatever that.
So
means.
When did you come to Halifax? What?
Be 74.
Yeah.
Stayed here till 88. No, 89.
Yeah. And we must have crossed paths somehow.
Oh, I'm sure.
Let's introduce your notorious sexuality into.
How did that occur? I think it's genetic.
When did you know? How did you come out?
Didn't come out until I was around. I didn't have. I think I knew when I was around 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And lived in fear and terror and trembling,
yeah.
Not because anybody was going to beat the shit out of me, it's just because I couldn't figure out how odd I was or why. because people and that, you know, that rural community oddity is not appreciated.
Yeah.
People who don't, people